Australian actors and filmmakers are now so much a part of the American movie scene that it's easy to forget that it wasn't until the late 1970s that the world even noticed that they made serious movies in Australia. One of the first films to grab international attention was Gillian Armstrong's My Brilliant Career, which made stars of its lead actors, Judy Davis and Sam Neill. The movie is just out on a new Blu-ray disc from Blue Underground, which has also released the film on DVD. Our critic at large, John Power, says that we can still feel its influence today.
A few months ago, I was watching a very entertaining documentary called Not Quite Hollywood, a rollicking look at the Australian exploitation movies of the 70s and early 80s. Although it was bursting with affection for gleefully bawdy and violent pictures, it got me thinking about the first non-exploitation Aussie movie I remember seeing, Gillian Armstrong's My Brilliant Career. Turns out, this is the 30th anniversary of that film's release. And after watching the gorgeous new version on Blu-ray, I can confidently say that this tale of a young woman's self-creation seems even better now than it did in 1979. Not least because our current movies have virtually no interest in women. My Brilliant Career is based on a 1901 novel by a teenage girl who wrote under the name of Miles Franklin. The time is the late 19th century, the place rural New South Wales, and the heroine Sybilla Melvin, a willfully, conflictedly headstrong young woman thrillingly played by Judy Davis. A born romantic, Sybilla dreams of being a writer, but everything is against it. Her family's poverty, her need to work as a servant, provincial society's hostility to her seemingly unwomanly ways. Then she meets a wealthy landowner named Harry Beecham. That's a young Sam Neill, who's never been so wolfishly charming. The two fall in love, but nothing is ever simple with Sybilla, and even as she leads Harry on, she also fends him off, actually slapping him with a riding crop the night he proposes marriage. Here Sybilla and Harry are talking the next day, and she tries to explain herself.
Could you? Can you give me a bit of time? Maybe 2 years. You see, I'm just not ready yet. Last night, I don't know, I think I was trying to hurt you. Make you let go. Do something. Give me a chance to find out what's wrong with the world and with me. Who I am. Everything. Then I'll marry you. If you need me, and I can help. You do understand, don't you?
When My Brilliant Career first came out in the U.S., it deservedly became a hit. Still, many critics wrote it off as merely another of the feminist fantasies common in the 1970s. It is that, but it's also something more. You see, most of the women's empowerment films of that era centered on women who were dumping a creep of a husband, sometimes swapping that creep for a sensitive artist. Here it's Sybilla who wants to be the artist, and what makes it tricky is that she loves a good guy who loves her precisely for her imagination and independence. The question is, can she have this love and achieve the brilliant writing career that she sees as her true destiny? As it happens, My Brilliant Career was itself destined to become a cultural watershed, one whose effects we can feel when we go to the movies or turn on our TVs. In fact, 30 years on, we're currently living in an era that will be remembered for being dominated by great Australian actresses. There are the ubiquitous stars like Cate Blanchett, Nicole Kidman, and Naomi Watts, who gave this decade's most brilliant performance in Mulholland Drive. There are the superb character actors like Toni Collette and Rachel Griffiths. And then there are the terrific up-and-comers like Mia Wasikowska, who stole the first season of In Treatment, and Abbie Cornish from the recent Bright Star. Now, I know there are strong American actresses, too. I'm well aware that Meryl Streep is a prodigy and that Sandra Bullock and Kate Hudson keep churning out hits. Still, it's modern Hollywood's shameful failing that it trains homegrown actresses to be likable. You know, not bitchy. Of course, that usually means being bland, girlish, uncomplicated, and totally unthreatening. That's why, when American filmmakers have a nice, complex role, they tend to cast an Aussie actress. And who can blame them? Australian actresses are less prepackaged. They're smart, tough, moody, and not cookie-cutter beautiful. Their good looks are born of intelligence and style. Better still, even their biggest stars are utterly fearless. They let themselves look plain, they don't demand star vehicles, and they're willing to play characters the audience actively dislikes. No doubt there are profound cultural reasons for all this, but there's also one straightforward explanation. Whenever I ask Aussie actresses who's inspired them, they always say the same thing. Judy Davis. It was Davis whose bravery, incandescence, and occasional cussedness set the template for what it means to be an Australian screen actress. She's the lodestar, the yardstick, and to this day, one of the world's great talents. In fact, if you want to know why this is the golden age of Australian actresses, you should start by watching Judy Davis play Sibella Melvin. She's the godmother of all those brilliant careers.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and writes the Absolute Powers column for Vogue.com.
When we invited writer David Sachs to send us an essay for our series, My Guilty Pleasure, he said he knew exactly what he would write about. The series lets authors recommend a book they are embarrassed to love. His choice was a huge bestseller, but it's mostly women who read it and talk about it. The book is Eat, Pray, Love. And David Sachs says it could be the best comeback story of our time.
2 winters ago, I was on a ski trip with my best friend. He'd recently graduated law school, hated his job, and was consumed by a fear that he'd failed in life and it was too late to start over, even though we were both 28. All weekend long, he dwelt on his depression, bringing it up in the chairlift, at dinner, in the sauna. He talked about his medications, his therapist, and the fear that he'd never be happy. I wanted to help, so I gave him my recently finished copy of Eat, Pray, Love by Elizabeth Gilbert. Gilbert, a successful writer, drags herself out of the depths of depression following a bitter divorce. She finds bliss in Italy, India, and Indonesia by surrendering to food, God, and romance. It's a quick read, filled with self-deprecating humor and a colorful cast of characters. I sure felt uplifted after reading it. Maybe my friend would too. Instead, he threw the book at me after reading a dozen pages. This is the stupidest book I've ever read. What part of this chick-lit crap did you think I'd like? It's not easy to be a fan of Eat, Pray, Love if you're a man. It is a scented candle of New Age wisdom. Eat, Pray, Love wasn't simply an Oprah book pick. It was the focus of 2 entire episodes of her show. They might as well have printed the thing in pink ink. It's pure literary estrogen. The book's haters are many. Gilbert's memoir is often dismissed as a beach read for unhappy housewives, a shallow tome that says all of life's problems can be fixed with Neapolitan pizza, a yoga retreat, and a good shtup with a wealthy foreigner. They're missing the point. Most transformative memoirs involve a protagonist overcoming unimaginable adversity. The poor kid who pulls himself out of the ghetto to attend the Ivy League. The war refugee who survives against terrible odds. The junkie returned from the depths of heroin's grasp. Inspiring, yes, but hardly relatable. Gilbert is suffering from shattered confidence. Who hasn't been there? Who hasn't cried on a bathroom floor, sure that our life is over at 32? Gilbert's beauty is that she isn't exceptional. She's just an ordinary gal with a broken heart and gift for writing. I passed Eat, Pray, Love along to my friend that weekend because it was the most believable comeback story I'd ever read. A few months later, he was on the mend. He got a better job, began a new romance, and found inner peace after a solo surf trip to Costa Rica. I didn't tell him, but it was a page right out of the Eat, Pray, Love playbook. You go, boy.
David Sachs is the author of Save the Deli, In Search of Perfect Pastrami, Crusty Rye, and the Heart of Jewish Delicatessen. He was recommending the book Eat, Pray, Love by Elizabeth Gilbert. Sachs tells us he eats well, doesn't pray enough, and loves his fiancé.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning.
It ain't as a sailor soul.
Today we're launching a new series we're calling Is That So? taking a look at the healthcare debate now going on in the Senate. The Senate is good at debating. It's what senators do, which doesn't mean they always get their facts straight. This morning, we've asked NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner to do a little fact checking. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Renee.
Let's begin with a comment by Connecticut Democrat Christopher Dodd. And we're going to be equal opportunity here, some Republicans, some Democrats. Senator Dodd is talking about how the health bill will benefit consumers.
On the day this bill is enacted, health insurance becomes a buyer's market, not a seller's market. And that's as American as apple pie.
Julie, a seller's market. Is that so?
Well, it may be so eventually, but definitely it will not be so on the day the bill is enacted. One of the things about both the House and the Senate bills that may come as a bit of a rude surprise to a lot of people is that most of the big changes won't take effect for several years. Things like the new health insurance marketplaces called exchanges, bans on pre-existing conditions, and subsidies to help people buy insurance won't kick in until 2013 in the House bill and not until 2014 in the Senate bill. Republicans say that's on purpose to make the bills look cheaper. The Congressional Budget Office only looks at the first 10 years of a law's life when they do their cost estimates. But frankly, it actually takes a while to get something of that magnitude up and running.
And along those lines, here's a comment from Iowa Republican Charles Grassley. He's one of the top Senate Republicans on health issues, and he's really steamed about the cost of this bill. Take a listen.
On the 10-year budget window, it is revenue neutral. But remember that that's 10 years of increased taxes and 6 years of program to make that happen. And so you raise the question, if it was 6 years of program and 10 years of income, would it be revenue neutral? Well, obviously not.
Julie?
Well, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the answer is not so obvious. The senator is right. The first 10 years includes 10 years of tax collections and only 6 years of benefits. But according to the CBO, in the second decade, the effect would likely be, quote, small reductions in federal budget deficits if all the provisions continued to be fully implemented. So no, Senator Grassley, that's not really so.
Well, thank you very much, Julie Rovner.
You're welcome.
Julie Rovner is NPR's health policy correspondent.
Assuming the deal goes through. Well, to talk more about the potential hurdles, I'm joined by Professor Jim Spetta. He specializes in telecommunications law at Northwestern University Law School. Professor Spetta, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You now have Comcast, the largest cable operator, one of the largest internet service providers, who will, if this goes through, own 1 out of 7 television channels. Is that a big threat to competition, do you think?
Well, that will be the first question that the regulatory review will look at. The antitrust authorities will ask whether there's decreased competition in any market. The argument will be, even if there's a consolidation of so many channels, where else do consumers look for to get entertainment and information?
What else would the regulators be looking at as potential obstacles here?
Well, they'll be looking at both the content market and the distribution market. As your report noted, the players are significant players in each of those two markets. And so they'll look at whether the combination reduces competition either in those markets or to competitors in those markets.
And what would be an example of how they might do that?
Well, for example, Comcast's content properties include some very important regional sports networks. And historically, regional sports networks have been very important to whether people take up particular kinds of cable subscriptions or direct satellite subscriptions. And so the question will be, if the content and the distribution are combined in this scale, could the combined company disadvantage other cable companies or satellite companies or even telephone companies?
Hmm. I guess another question here would be, could Comcast give its own content, say an NBC program or a Universal movie, priority if people were going to view it using Comcast internet or cable service?
That's exactly the flip side, and both sides of that question will be examined. And in fact, the antitrust authorities and the Federal Communications Commission has looked at just this question in previous combinations of content providers and distribution companies. For example, in the News Corp DirecTV merger or in the AOL Time Warner merger, which of course is in the process of being undone.
And what did they find when they looked at those?
Well, in both of those situations, the Federal Communications Commission imposed some requirements on the companies that essentially they deal fairly with their competitors with respect to content and distribution. In fact, this morning, Comcast released 4 pages of conditions that they proposed to the regulators that follow basically the blueprint that the FCC set up in those earlier mergers.
Is this of an order of magnitude greater than the other examples that you mentioned? I mean, one critic of this talked about it being the most important merger since Lucy met Desi today.
I do think this is the communications merger of the decade, and it is on a scale different from and bigger than the previous mergers. The big question in media these days is not just traditional forms of channels, of cable programming, or even of broadcast programming, but of also all of the content available outside of those distribution medias, like through internet video. And so the marketplace is changing. This may be a bigger deal in traditional television and cable television, but whether it's a bigger deal in the media marketplace is sort of where all the action is for the regulators.
And in the end, do you assume the regulators will look at this, ask questions, but ultimately approve it?
I believe that ultimately, and this is just my personal opinion, ultimately it will be approved with some conditions. Earlier today, one of the FCC commissioners, Michael Copps, who has had a very long-standing concern with media consolidation, issued a statement in which he said that it would be, quote, a very steep climb for him to reach approval of the merger. So I think there will be an extended regulatory review process. My personal belief is that eventually it will be approved.
Professor Spetta, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
That's Professor Jim Spetta. He teaches telecommunications law at Northwestern University Law School.
A couple of years ago, a Gallup poll found that 85% of college football fans, 85%, preferred a playoff system to determine the national champions. Now, when you run that 85% through the complicated computerized formula used by the Bowl Championship Series, it goes down to 0%. We still have the BCS. NPR sports correspondent Mike Pesca joins us to answer the question here first. What really is the BCS? How's it work?
Well, we know it stands for the Bowl Championship Series, and it is a number of bowls that happened in 2010, but everyone looks at the national championship game. And what the BCS does is it makes a unified national champion. It takes the first-ranked team, pits them against the second-ranked team, and everyone can agree, well, yes, the winner of this game we shall call the national champion.
How do they decide who gets to play in that national title game?
It's complicated. They poll coaches. They have six different computers using six different formulas, crunching numbers. And then they have something called the Harris Interactive Poll, which has a slate of electors, and getting on there is more complex than the rules of succession to the Spanish throne. But what this shows is that complexity doesn't equal consensus, because even though you have all these numbers flying around and these supposedly learned people voting, there's still a lot of question. Why is this team number one and why is this team number two when an equally undefeated team perhaps can't crack the top three? Doesn't seem fair to a lot of people.
And that's especially painful this year when there are so many undefeated teams late in the season.
Yeah, a lot of years there are undefeated teams who are seen as weak sisters. You know, a few years ago, Tulane, I think, went 11-0. But this year, Cincinnati, the University of Cincinnati, which plays in the Big East, which is supposedly a power conference, they're undefeated. We know that Texas Christian University is undefeated. And Boise State is undefeated, and perhaps we could write off Boise State, but the first game of the season, they did defeat Oregon. And Oregon plays in the Pac-10, and they went on to beat, Oregon did, a lot of teams who everyone else knows are good. And this is what the BCS forces you to do. It forces you to extrapolate, and you have to say, well, they beat a team who beat another team, so maybe Boise State's pretty good. And you ask the six computers and the Harris Interactive poll and the third guy in line for the Spanish throne, then we're going to know who's in the national championship game.
Mike Pesca, why not just take the top four or eight teams and have a few rounds of playoffs?
Well, the real reason is money. The bowls make a lot of money for the teams that play in them, the people who own the bowls, networks, etc., etc. The only problem is in every other sport in America, we do use a playoff system. So we have decided that playoffs are the best way to determine champions everywhere else, except in this one hugely followed enterprise called Division 1A college football.
So granting that people will be dissatisfied with the results of the BCS once again this year, will at least some people be satisfied?
if the following scenario happens, which is what the football poobahs and the people who decide and are invested in the BCS want to happen, which is they want the winner of the undefeated Florida and Alabama game get one slot in the championship game, and they really want the other slot to go to Texas because they're also an undefeated team. However, if Texas loses to Nebraska, there's a possibility that they will bypass an undefeated team and let a one-loss team play in the playoff game because the computer and the voters and the coaches and so forth will tell them what to do. So that would be a sort of chaos scenario.
NPR's Mike Pesca remains very high in the computerized rankings of sports correspondents. Mike, thanks very much.
Thank you.
In Hollywood, they're already into the season this December. That would be the awards season. Film critic Kenneth Turan says one movie that deserves the buzz around it, the chatter about a possible Oscar, is opening this weekend, Up in the Air.
Up in the Air makes it look easy. It blends entertainment and insight, comedy and poignance, even drama and reality, and never seems to break a sweat. Up in the Air stars George Clooney as Ryan, a corporate hitman who flies around the country firing people for companies who are too timid to do it themselves. Ryan loves the soothing predictability that goes with high-end business travel. He's made a science of security lines and moves cards through optical devices like scanning was an Olympic sport. Two women throw Ryan off his confident stride. First is a whip-smart numbers cruncher from his office, played by Anna Kendrick, who questions everything he believes in. She's frankly dubious as he tells her about his personal quest for 10 million frequent flyer miles.
Isn't 10 million just a number?
Pi's just a number.
Well, we all need a hobby. No, I don't mean to belittle your collection. I get it. It sounds cool.
I'd be the seventh person to do it. More people have walked on the moon.
Did they throw you a parade?
You get lifetime executive status. You get to meet the chief pilot, Maynard Finch.
Wow.
And they put your name on the side of a plane.
If you guys don't grow up, it's like you need to pee on everything.
Then Ryan catches the eye of a business traveler named Alex, who shares his love for frequent flying and who is as passionate about the system as he is.
I put up pretty pedestrian numbers, like 60,000 a year domestic.
It's not bad.
You don't patronize me. What's your total?
That's a personal question.
Oh, please.
Well, we hardly know each other.
Oh, come on. Show some hubris. Come on. Impress me. I bet it's huge.
You have no idea.
Played by the exceptional Vera Farmiga, Alex is so much Ryan's psychic twin that he finds himself synchronizing schedules with her so they can share steamy airport rendezvous. Credit for all this goes to writer-director Jason Reitman, who used a novel by Walter Kern as his jumping-off point. The question Up in the Air poses is whether Ryan's detachment can survive contact with genuine emotion. The answer turns out to be complex, a further reason to celebrate a director who has filmmaking in his bones.
Critic Kenneth Turan, this is NPR News.